Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
And me, Ben Hobson.
And me, Jane Maguire.
Today we're talking with photographer and filmmaker Emily May about the art of capturing running on the move.
Which we all know is famously easy, Rick, if you've ever seen a race photo or anything like that. We all look great in those.
Has anyone ever looked good in a race photo? Have you ever had one where you're like, that? They've nailed that, that's perfect, that's going on the wall?
No.
No.
It doesn't happen, does it?
Oh, they've caught me in the most fluid and wonderful moment of my running gait. Oh, I look so powerful and graceful. No. It's always that sort of slightly squashed down moment where you're kind of like, just, you know, you've just landed and everything's kind of like, meh.
Yeah. My mum always gets me a marathon photo frames, and I had to say to her, I put these in the bin, I literally burn them, and then I keep the frame and put a new photo in. You are wasting your money. Stop doing it. But there
is
we
it
go.
The photographer's fault? This are we blaming the photographers
100%.
Here for what might be sorting out our running form?
No,
or is it? No, it's photographers.
Evil people with cameras. That's where
always late on as well. Always like the last mile. Do it the first mile. Everyone looks good in the first mile, don't they?
And do you know what's also annoying? And this has happened to me before. Is you're running and you're like, oh, you know, this is hell on earth. And then you see a cameraman and you're like, oh, for goodness sake. And then someone in front of you decides to, like, do a star jump and punches you in the face. And you're just like...
Oh, right. I see.
You're like, having to suddenly break to avoid an arm for a fun pose. And yeah. I must be in the back of some race photos giving, you know, wishing people dead. So just... No, just a big no from me.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's true, actually. If it's got like mile, I don't know, 20 of, you know, a marathon and someone's trying to get a snazzy race photo and causing
you
mayhem.
You both know I've got resting bitch face at the best of times, but put a marathon or any race and a camera and other people in the mix and it's not pretty.
Oh, well, I'm glad that Emily's on now. She can really help us all find, I don't know, better creative processes or something whenever it comes to these things.
Yeah, she just offers some practical advice, doesn't she, about like what the or the every man or woman photographer can get if you're not particularly sort of skilled in this area, which is definitely something I sympathize with. I don't think I've ever taken a good photo. There's been a lot of, I often get my thumb in a photo by accident.
Oh, we're back to basics here with Rick.
Classic.
You're quite good though, Ben. You're actually quite good at this stuff.
I don't know if I've got good at it. I've taken enough of them to sort of, you know, out of, if you take enough, there's always one that you can kind of like polish to look relatively decent. But that's about it. I mean, Emily comes on as well because she's made a movie about running in its sort of most purest of forms. So sort of the capturing, as we talk about her capturing running, we've got the imagery the pictures she's taken over the years, but now this the Church of the Long Run Tracksmith movie, which everyone should go and watch because it's a very different approach to the portrayal of running, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like, there's nothing cut, isn't there? It's like 90 minutes of
the six. She says there's six cut. It's basically filming someone on their long run, and it's set to music, and it's all very very long shots with maybe six cuts in between each one of them. And it flies in the face of 13 seconds on Instagram, that's for sure.
Yeah, so, exactly the opposite of like of most social media minded running content, isn't it? It's like long form in every sense.
Exactly.
Yeah, worth a look.
Yeah, really good to chat to Emily about the how that came together and sort of the ideas behind it. But talking of long runs, Rick.
Oh yes,
you've dug up some stats for us on some races in the UK, haven't you? Which is
I have. So New Balance have been on a noble quest to establish what is Britain's toughest road marathon.
Mm.
Obviously, there's like loads of hard trail marathons, aren't there? They almost like sell themselves on elevation or how punishing it is. But I think road marathons probably tend to trade more on like
speed. It's PB, speed, right? PB ability, PB, isn't it? That's like
exactly. And you might get one that's like scenery or something, where these kind of coastal ones where you might say, "Oh, you know," but most of it's like it's PB. So New Balance got a list, an 8-strong list of marathons. I think the headline news is that there's one that's way harder than all the rest, and it's it's done on a percentage of DNFs, so sort of percentage of people who start but don't finish. And in number one is a Langdale Marathon in the Lake District, 15% DNF. To put that in perspective, number two, DNF is only 5.3%. So it's very, very easily the hardest marathon in the UK. It's got an elevation gain of roughly the same as going up Snowdon. So that's probably why people drop out. It's two laps of very hilly course. But it's an interesting list, actually. I'll just give you the top five because this gives you a sense of like kind of the talking points about it. But you've got Langdale Marathon, which is really, really hard. And then you've got Southampton Marathon, which isn't notoriously hard. Then you've got Abingdon Marathon, which is actually notoriously quick. Then you've got Snowdonia Marathon, which is hard. And Milton Keynes, which again is quick. So it's quite, the reasons people drop out, it's not just because it's tough. I think sometimes with something like Abingdon, it's like, I'm going only for a PB. I'm not getting that PB. Yeah. Oh God, I might as well just drop out. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, that's it. You sort of, when we were going over the list, you can see those ones where people use them very much as races to qualify for things or to get like times in the bank. And if it's not going well, then they just immediately stop running because there's no point. And then obviously the ones that are just hard. But as you were saying, like that one's got, that Langdale's got as much elevation as Snowdonia, but Snowdonia is on that list, isn't it?
Yeah, so the Snowdonia Marathon is on the list. Langdale's got the equivalent of actually going up Snowdon, so Mount Snowdon, but whereas Snowdonia Marathon is kind of in and around the lumpy pass, but there's God. No, it's not.
Do you know what we can all conclude? It's that I'm not the only person, I'm not the only runner that hates hills.
Yeah,
I'm
Jane.
From this.
Well, would you even be at the start line, Jane?
Hell
That's
no.
The
so- Absolutely never.
There we go.
I fancy Langdale because you see some of the images of it. It's worth any listeners checking out. Just go, and it's hills you just do not see on road marathons. It's like, oh my God, that's like, it's like sort of 25% kind of gradient.
God, there you go. Team trip.
Could be a team trip.
Hell no. Send me a postcard. I'm there in spirit.
There's some other stats here actually that are probably worth having a quick mention of. So research found that 65% of people who drop out any marathon do so after the halfway point. And after that, the most significant marker for dropping out is mile 23. I'm quite surprised at that because I feel like if you drop out of a marathon, a lot of people would do it before halfway because it might be through injury or whatever, where this looks more like people just perhaps haven't trained or, you know, it's further than they realise.
3 miles. I mean, you've basically got 5K to go.
Yeah, it's quite close to finish.
Like
isn't it?
That is a bleak part, but that to me is always the part of the marathon where I just turn my brain off. I can't remember. I've probably seen you both around mile 23, and
yeah, that's true. Actually,
completely ignored you, not recognised you, have no idea who you are.
Yeah, that's true.
But maybe if you can't get into that, like, switch your brain off stage.
Yeah.
Maybe you just think, why am I doing this?
It would be interesting how much of the DNF stuff falls into just like absolute collapse, because that's 23 is kind of where you see people like
hobbling along.
We saw a guy trip, didn't we, Rick, at the marathon? Do you remember that?
That's about mile 24,
really late on, and he's just one of those things where fatigue and tiredness came in and he tripped and it looked like he hit his head, because then he was that was it. So you kind of like,
it's serious, isn't it?
It wasn't a fun thing. So it was you kind of get that factored in, don't you, to the whole doesn't finish thing.
But that's true. Just getting totally exhausted. There's a big difference in men and women with this. Apparently 16% of men that DNF do it with 3 miles to go, whereas it's only 5.4% of women. So that might be a pacing issue, because there is some evidence to suggest that women are better at pacing long distance races, and blokes have gone off too quickly and then have hit some
imploded.
Sort of wall. Yes.
All that ego.
All that ego.
Bloody ego everywhere.
Stupid ego man.
Official.
There's a soundbite for the podcast. I'll go now.
Well, there you go, everyone. If you think that you've got a race that you think's harder that you've done, road, it's a road race. And we know trail is difficult. If you've got a road race that you think's more challenging than the Langdale, well, let us know. podcast@runnerswild.co.uk. We'll get it in the mix. We'll try and we'll see what the data suggests. So give us some more to look at. It'd be interesting to know.
I'm interested, Ben, because you've been training to something that's quite under the radar, I think. Is it the easy interval method? And could you expand, please, for the listener?
Oh, wait, I haven't got my book with me.
What are you training for?
Well, I'm doing the Landmarks Half with you.
Nice.
Remember that?
Oh yeah.
So,
yeah. See you there.
I'm very early stages in it. I was put onto it by my mate Andy, and it comes from a training method from a book by a Dutch athlete called Klaus Luuk, I think is how you would say his name, and it was translated by a runner called Russ Mullen. And it's, the clue's in the title, it's called the Easy Interval Method, and it breaks down running into a sort of set of different intervals from sort of 200 meters through to kilometer efforts. But it's all done sort of within the parameters of lactate and aerobic threshold. So you're not like, it's not like intervals where you'd go and do repeats and you're absolutely like battered. That's not the premise. This is all about sort of controlled effort. It's been really interesting because
what's the book called?
It's called The Easy Interval Method.
Oh, right. Okay. All right.
And it's just actually had a bit of a reboot. There's a few more pages now as a new issue that's just come out, which is what Russ has just sent me. So I'm making my way through that, and I've done a few things now. It's going nicely. You don't feel so beaten up, but you can kind of like feel that there are improvements in your aerobic condition rather than just purely anaerobic. So you're kind of like building the aerobic system to be able to cope with effort more, so that you're not just in the anaerobic kind of like state for too long. It's a learning curve, Rick, but who knows? We'll see what happens.
Mate, it's really interesting. It's, yeah, like intervals finding their way into all your running.
Yeah.
It's quite an unusual approach. It's a little bit Zatopek-y in that sense. And
yeah.
I think it'd be interesting to see what it does to your running, because it's not something that a lot of people have probably tried, I think.
Yeah. I'm yet to sort of like finish reading it completely and work it all out. But the few things I've applied so far have been good.
Jane, how about you? What's going on?
Training a little bit again, doing a bit of stuff. But I found, I think when I was before the old twisted ankle dog walking injury of 2022, I had a few issues with my hip. I've got my hip run, like when I'm running, it's fine. After I'm running, it's not fine.
Okay.
And with the old twisted ankle, obviously I didn't run a lot. And when I did, I was doing very gentle running for the, you know, since about October, and now I've stepped it up again. The hip's not happy, so it's one of those. Should probably sort it out, but I don't know. It's just that, you know, that like annoying kind of niggly.
Yeah. Not enough to stop you running, but like.
Not enough, but a bit annoying. Just a bit annoying. Yeah. A bit there. So gonna go to the GP. Go to the old-fashioned route. See what's wrong.
See what's happening. See what's going on.
Well,
there's a good quote from Scott Jurek, the great ultra runner, and he writes in his book, "Not all pain is significant," which I think is probably true. Actually, it's not. If something's hurting, it's not necessarily a red light. Obviously, there's levels of this, isn't there? But that's all Scott Jurek. That's from the top. That's coming from the top.
Right? He knows what he's talking about. I think the training plan I'm doing is quite. I've always been quite a 80-20 runner, and this is probably a bit harder and a bit more like going to the track to kill myself kind of vibe.
Not easy and intervals, then. Not easy intervals.
Pretty much the opposite of Ben's plan, and I'm wondering whether that type of training doesn't suit my body, and whether this is a sign that I'm an 80-20 runner, and you know, who cares about running faster? Stick in your lane, kind of thing. But we'll see. We'll see how this pans out.
You've got to move. You've got to move from your lane sometimes, just to see what it's like. And then if it's not for you, you just move back again. I think
if it's not for you, pop back. Who wants to be in lane one?
Rick, you're just fine, aren't you, mate?
I am getting better. Actually, I'm being a bit better at the strength and conditioning work, which definitely makes a big difference with any knee trouble I've had. And I'm going to do this a Parlauf event on Saturday, which is a sort of a two-person relay.
Right.
I think it started in Germany. I can't remember what it means, something in German. Can't remember. Let's say two-person relay.
Yeah, good. Direct translation.
Just a DIY thing. There's like about 10 of us just doing around Crystal Palace Park on Saturday morning. It's going to be about maybe 3 miles or something in total. Some good runners, actually. So the key will be not to finish last. That's what me and my mate George are trying to do. Don't finish last. Then go and have a coffee afterwards. And I'll let you know how I get on. I've never done a parlaf before, but should be quite fun, I think.
Well, we invite all listeners to go.
That's the most rich thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's a very rich thing. And we invite all listeners who live in the South London area to go to Crystal Palace Park or whatever it is that you're, and cheer him on.
I really, really wish you were doing like parkour or something instead. That's where my brain was. You just like
Ricky Georgia
running up walls and backflipping.
No, yeah, it's very different. Very different. And yeah, a little bit safer. And yeah. We'll see how it goes. But no, nice. Yeah, trying to add some more quick running in. Yeah, looking forward to doing the half marathon in April with you guys. And yeah, all right. Feeling optimistic. Going to do the spine race sooner or later. We all are. Comes to us all.
No, thanks.
Yeah, stay in your lane, Rick. Stay in your lane.
Yeah. Hey, look, should we go on our guest of the week then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Guest of the week. Here in the studio. Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone.
Emily, welcome to the Runner's World podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you mind telling us a bit about yourself and how you first got into running and photography and those sorts of things?
Absolutely. My name is Emily May, and I am a photographer, director. I live in California. I also have a place in Brooklyn. I split my time between the two, sort of do the summer in Santa Barbara and the winter in New York, which is often the opposite of what people would imagine would be my desire. I actually really love the winter in New York. I am the photographer for Tracksmith and have been since the day that the brand started. So it's about 8.5 years now that I've been working with them and directing a lot of the films as well. And that was my first running photography that I did was for Tracksmith. Just before the brand had started, I shot something for their magazine piece for Meter. That was the Ivy League Indoor Track Championships in Hanover, New Hampshire. And that was my first time shooting running, and I had come from shooting cycling a lot at that time. And so it was a very different experience, and that's what brought me to running.
What are some of the unique challenges of trying to shoot running as opposed to cycling? Is it what kind of things you have to kind of conquer as a photographer, do you think?
Yeah, they're very different. I think that cycling, obviously you move through so much space and obviously at a quicker speed. And I remember one of the first shoots that we did for Tracksmith, very inspired by the curve of the road or something that, you know, you see, and there's a little bit of a crossover between cycling and running in terms of the way that you're out in space. And so I remember us going up the road like a little bit too far to be like, oh, this is beautiful. Like, we'll shoot here. This is a nice spot. And then being like, oh, they won't be here for quite a while, as opposed to cycling. You have to really rush ahead and make sure that, you know, you get a pretty good distance because they really come very fast. And my work with cycling was with the pro teams for Tour de France. And I spent about four or five seasons with Truck Factory Racing team through their entire calendar and all their races and training and stuff. So dealing with very, very quick riders. Yeah, right. And so you've got to get a lot of distance before they come around. And so running is a little bit different in that sense. But I would say that the fact that you have a machine in cycling, that you have something to interact with, certainly changes the way that your body language is, the way that you hold the handlebars or that you're climbing or out of the saddle or something. There might be something different dynamic that changes in the body depending on the terrain. And running is a little bit more straightforward, although much harder to shoot because you, on the bike, kind of if a rider has 1 foot up and 1 foot down, you're pretty good as long as a lot of the other elements are in play. But with running, there's just a lot more to capturing the form that is a bit trickier in terms of foot strike and, you know, all those things, and making sure that it looks nice. It's a bit harder.
I mean, I don't think anyone has ever got that email saying, here are your race photos, please take a look. And they've clicked that link and gone, they've really captured the dynamic effort that I was putting into that final. You know, race photos tend to look pretty flat and kind of you're like, they catch you at the wrong moment and you look kind of squashed and all this sort of stuff. And the way that, you know, everyone documents their running these days with photos and videos and things like that, how do you go about sort of looking, I mean, beyond the aesthetic with Tracksmith, say, but just as capturing running and it's sort of like the movement of it, are you looking for athletes who are just very, very good at running, or is it more than that? Is it more like the dynamic that they bring to the image, or the sort of effort that they're putting in? How does it, what makes a good image?
Yeah, I definitely like to say that I shoot the person doing the sport, not the sport itself. Like, to me, there's a personality and there's a sense of something that is extra on top of just what's going on in the moment with the body. And so that's like what makes the image a little bit more compelling, I think, too, is what is that person's energy like, I guess, you know. And I came from ballet. I was a very serious ballet dancer when I was young, and my mom was a professional ballet dancer, and that's what I very much wanted to do with my life. And I think that that history of ballet and being a part of it and photographing it and the whole world of watching other dancers and all that, you start to learn body language without sound in a way that is really linked to storytelling and in terms of the photos that I take. And so I think there's something in that that allows me to know when it's the right photo too. And, you know, in that selection process, just having a sense of how body language is communicated through images is really important to me. And I think you can see that in the way that I photograph runners, that there's something about the grace or just a moment that feels like it's the right moment. And sometimes that is like a heavy effort moment, and it is something where it's not all light and 2 feet floating off the ground, and, you know, there's like a nice connection to the ground that actually gives you a sense of effort in a different way. It's just about body language. It's not about always being I guess aspirational, a sense of like, oh, this is so easy. Sometimes showing how hard it is way more aspirational than making it look easy. And I think that's something I would definitely bring to what I do at Tracksmith.
How important do you think top of the range kit is when it comes to capturing a great photo? Or can most people, or can you achieve great things on just a standard smartphone?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I thought you meant like a running kit, like how
apparel. I thought you meant apparel too, Rick. I thought you said like,
maybe that helps probably.
I think that's, as a side digression, I think the actual, you know, clothing, the actual aesthetic of the clothing, from having come from shooting for Rafa previously and shooting for Tracksmith, that always does make a difference when you sort of see a photo of somebody that it's just everything's mismatched, you know, and sort of very very bad fit. You're like, oh, like I think the photo is probably fine. It's just
it's just the clothes are terrible.
Color scheme into like a neutral space or something here. In terms of camera kit, I'm not a big gear person, and I change cameras all the time. It's kind of one of the running jokes too about I shot on Canon for a really long time, and I switched to Nikon. I sort of found that people wanted, you know, larger people. There was a lot of times where agencies would get the, could you shoot on medium format, was like a buzzword for a really long time. That was something that they would ask you. And then, you know, it's going on Instagram anyways. And so it was a funny switch that sort of happened where everybody shot on the larger megapixel cameras. And so I switched in that. And then I decided on a whim to try the Sonys out during the pandemic. And I left my apartment in New York to come to California to work with the NBA team, the Clippers. And I was like, I'm gonna bring this Sony camera that I have and try it out, because I haven't really tried it out. And we were going to do the speed project for the second time with Tracksmith, and it seemed like that was easy to shoot on that gear. And then, you know, lockdown happened, and I was stuck with Sony cameras for 2 years something in California, and had to shoot everything on those. And I recently just switched over to Fuji, and I just play around with it. And I shot with the Leica that has no screen for a while. I shot the Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, Oxford track me on that. And you can't even format the card without tethering it to your phone. It just doesn't even have a format button. It was completely impractical, manual focus. Like, I brought that to that track meet. And sometimes I like to put a little bit of an impediment with the tool sometimes, just to, it makes you rise to the occasion a little bit. And try to, like, I don't know, see it differently. You know, you're always trying to like trigger your brain to see images and to be involved in the process. And so sometimes switching up the kit is like a fun way to do that, or take a different camera.
Yeah, I think so. I think that everyone's sort of now armed with the ability to take a picture with smartphones and things like that. But certainly doesn't mean that you're going to get something good. And I think that that's kind of where the sort of the skill set comes in terms of, especially with running. As we say, like, it's such a sort of nuanced art of like making sure that people look fluid yet powerful, yet all the sort of elements that make a good picture. How just with a smartphone and everyone sort of documenting these things with social media, what would you be your top tips? What would you say to someone who was just like, is it the lighting? Is it the position? When you're sort of like framing up a shot of someone, what's the sort of like the tick list?
I mean, lighting's everything, right? I think like lighting is so key. Lighting is really nice. I was, you know, I've worked for a lot of different brands, and sometimes you get these lists that are generated by marketing companies where they've gone to people and sort of pulled like what is successful photographically. And so you get this feedback from those, and data can be interpreted a lot of different ways. And so remember getting a in and out list where it was like, these things are in and these things are out. And it was, you know, anything that was like positive was in, and anything that was like suffering and negative was like out. And it had drawn these like really clear lines on like what was in and what was out. And I remember saying to the art director, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but I will point out that there's great light in all of these in photos and terrible light in all of these out photos. And you've given people no context for this answer, but it might just be that people like nice light and people don't like bad light. So it was kind of a funny way to think about it. But yeah, I mean, I think it's nice that photography, it's easy to hate on Instagram as a photographer and say, you know, sort of everyone thinks that they can do it. And I think that it actually makes people really appreciate photography more, and they see so much of it, and they're able to see such a variety of it that people start to really curate what they like. They know the difference between, you know, their dad's photos, like their family or something that they like from an emotional standpoint of like, you know, person I know, and like, I like the content of this, and I like seeing my friend's kids, and I like those kids, or, you know, it's just like something that you then know how to differentiate between what makes a photo that moves you because of its photographic quality versus the content in it. And so I think people actually are really savvy to like what looks good and what doesn't. I shoot so much on my iPhone, to be honest. I'm always pulling it out. I wish I shot more on a real camera in my own life when I was documenting things. It is just that always in your pocket and you're just compelled to take a picture. So, you know, I certainly do that quite a bit.
Talking about Instagram and the sort of impact that social media has played in documenting the way that things move forward, if you sort of go back to the significance of pictures in key moments within running, you've got like Roger Bannister's sub four and like the iconic imagery that comes with that, and just sort of Jesse Owens at the Olympics, and you know, those images are all sort of there in the running history. Do you think that the impact that imagery has now, because everyone looks at it all day long, does it diminish the significant moments, or do you think that actually it's just part of the evolution of how things are captured and it does more for the sport because it's out there way more?
That's a great question. I think I'm sure it does more for the sport because of being out there in terms of eyeballs on the sport, but there's something so beautiful about those photos that are iconic photos from that were hard to make. You know, I think about that a lot with cycling. When I was shooting cycling, there were so many photographers shooting all the time, and you know, everybody releases their gallery each day that is their perspective on that race day, and you just know how hard it was to make photos 20 years before that, where you were responsible for the news photograph. I love talking to Getty photographers and news agency photographers when I'm around them. I've shot a couple basketball games for the NBA and been, you know, courtside, and I try to talk to those guys. And I say guys because they're often men. But I think that it's nice to talk to them. Like, I feel like sometimes people hate on that part of things, but the news photograph as like a record of events is a really stressful job that requires you to be in the right place at the right time and get the shot. And I think the Olympics becomes a time where we see that prioritized more with photography, where someone gets a shot. You think of that shot of Usain Bolt, like looking to his right.
There's Usain Bolt with a lightning bolt hitting the stadium.
Oh God, that was amazing.
And he's and you're like, come on, that's incredible. That was
incredible. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the other thing that I think about with that a lot lately is some of these documentaries that have come out, that The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary, some of the music documentaries that have come out, the Aretha Franklin one, because they couldn't originally sync the sound. They didn't slate it properly. And so they weren't able to release it because the sound wasn't synced, from my understanding. And so technology can now auto do that. And so they were able to release that film, you know, and you hadn't seen that moment when she's recording the gospel album in the church. And it's such beautiful footage to see now. And certainly when you're watching The Last Dance, you just think like, will this ever exist? The Beatles doc too, which I'm super, super obsessed with and watched so many times. Will people ever have this experience in the future with anything that's happening right now? Nobody's really filming things like that just for the sake of it. Nobody's really like filming, as far as I know, there's just like a designated output for everything that's being filmed. So if LeBron is having his 20th year and, you know, the documentary crew, it's either signed off or it's not. And it's managed through like a media team, I would imagine, that decides, you know, what can be seen and what can't. So will we have that anymore? Like, are people shooting those moments that are unfolding that will be history in the future? And I think that's really sad to think that maybe we wouldn't have those experiences, because I've really, really treasured that as a observer, what's come out recently, some archive footage.
I think historically, running's probably not been looked at as something that's kind of fashionable in terms of aesthetic. Whereas I think actually cycling's always had a fashion to it. But do you think that running is catching up in some ways with brands like Tracksmith and other brands who are actually making really good looking, fashionable running kit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, cycling has a costume culture to it. That's a big part of it. But there was a point where cycling was not, I guess historically was very fashionable. If you look at the photos in the 60s and stuff, I mean, that's just so good. But there was a point in sort of the, you know, 90s, early 2000s, pre-Rafa, where all you could get was replica kit and go out and look like, you know,
riding. Rick, the modern era sits in stark contrast to some of the kit that was made in the 80s and stuff like that. Yeah. It was wild.
Yeah. So there's evolution there that happened too, you know, I think, and I do think that that's certainly, you know, very obviously happening in running and has happened. And Tracksmith was a big part of that started. And I think everybody wants to look good when they go out and run, right? I think it helps. It seems like it helps, you know.
There's science behind it. If you look good, you're going to run better. That's, you know, that's a real thing. But I think it's interesting what Rick says about, you know, brands and looking good and certainly the impact that that has. But where does it start from? Do you take like the impact that, say, like Nike had on the like the aesthetic of running in, say, like the 70s? And like you see the imagery that like there was a certain look, Prefontaine, kind of like that aspirational brand dictating kind of the direction it was going. Similarly, Tracksmith has a very specific aesthetic to it, and that dictates sort of like a look. There are brands like Saw in the UK, which is very sort of like, you know, has a certain aesthetic. Again, it's quite sort of racy.
Yeah, there's more technical brands that want to be like, you know, really high tech or futuristic, you know, and obviously that's going to, I think the imagery is going to follow along the lines of the brand ethos. You know, if you're shooting for a really techie brand in any space, you know, it probably will be shot in a way that, that is a more fashion sort of editorial approach, you know? And I think that, you know, I think that with Tracksmith, there's beyond just the clothes, but in terms of the way that we approach imagery, there's been a conversation and a sense of storytelling from the beginning, from authenticity in a way that really is how the stories are told, that there's not a sense of writing out the shot list ahead of time and making sure you get that feeling and like, okay, we nailed it. It really does come from within. I mean, like, what is the reflection of how the brand sees running and what they want to say about it, what they want to show about it. And so it comes from that place where it's dictated from within the storytelling of the brand that then the photos come out of that, you know, from a really good place.
Because I think that some people would want to strive to have their aesthetic lead in a way that they want everyone to look a certain way, because that kind of like how they want to define running. But I think that if the image comes from a purpose of just storytelling, it's a very different approach to sort of putting a brand out there.
Yeah, and the clothes are very cohesive across the board, right? In terms of, it's not seasonally changing in a way that you're like, whoa, you can't put, you know, this imagery next to this imagery. Like, we're doing totally different things. I mean, there's a sense of, you know, a continuation of the story that is happening within the clothes as well. And so I think that even just alongside each other, you know, when we shoot a collection, it's very easy to mix and match. The colors all have been thought really considerably. You know, the creative director is very, very keen to make sure that it all looks really nice together and that it looks nice in nature. You know, I think that's a big part of the imagery that I'm always struck by, is how the clothes look, you know, on a lay down at first when you're mocking them up, but they're outside in the world. And when you shoot the images, they're outside in the world, and it's just a really nice harmony in those color palettes with where we are in nature and different textures of nature. And so that makes my job very easy, to make beautiful images when there's a nice cohesion between, you know, the locations that they choose are really beautiful. And I can just come in there and make it look good.
Can we talk about filming running as well? Because we know you've got a film out, the Church of the Long Run. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about and give us a brief summary about what it's all about, really?
Yeah, Church of the Long Run is a 84-minute film that we've just made that is runner Sam Recker going for a run on a very snowy, mountainous road in Colorado. And this is a project that we wanted to do for a really, really long time. It's something we've talked about, and I've worked a lot in the film space with Tracksmith and continually trying to push what we're doing and how ambitious it is. And so this is definitely our most ambitious project yet. And you starts with an empty road, and that's something where we've recently been running some images of empty roads with some quotes from runners about their long runs on Sundays, and just trying to create that sense of the road itself is a beautiful image and a place that's desirable to go get out there and run. And so it opens on an empty road and pans to find Sam walking to start her run, and continues with her for the entire run until she comes back. And so it's in real time, and there's about 6 cuts in it. So really, really long, continuous takes. It minimally interferes with her run as a viewer, and you're able to be a fly on the wall. And I think that's something that is really unique to get the opportunity to do. And I know it can sound like, who would watch that? Who's going to watch 84 minutes of somebody running? But it's been really, really beautiful to see some of the comments from people that have watched it all the way through. It's got a beautiful score to it. And it's an experience, you know. I think as you settle in and watch it, your eye moves around on the road and you see different scenery and you notice different things. And it's something that really you can only experience by giving the time to it, in the same way that when she goes out and runs, it's you can't really make a highlight reel of it. You know, she has to put in the time and experience different emotions and different things as she's going. And so I think the viewer, I'm seeing that people are responding that way, that they're getting that if they put in the time and do that. And it, you know, in the current TikTok landscape, I would say it's the complete opposite of what's going on currently. And I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of where it sits in that landscape.
I've got so much to ask about it. But one of the first things was, it sits in stark contrast to what you might see on YouTube particularly, but also the sort of the immediate, like 15 seconds of input and then you're out again. Like there's the attention span is very much based on real time, and you've got all of that. And even on storytelling videos on YouTube, very much follow a very certain aesthetic, which are quite loud. It's quite in your face, it's lots of cuts, there's lots of sort of edits, da, 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 da. So it's kind of interesting that would be to do the exact opposite, to go against what the trends are, and for it to work. Because, you know, this me being a skeptic when I first saw it, and I was just a bit like, wait, it's just 84 minutes of someone running.
I love that. I'm glad you're skeptical. I'm glad.
but you know, I've watched it, and as you say, and it's all the elements that you have when you run personally. It's hypnotic. The score is phenomenal. Like, I just think that carries it just, you know, you could, that really sort of transports you a little bit to where, to being on the run with Sam, and makes it sort of feel, it ebbs and flows so nicely with perhaps the way that the landscape is, or the way that the emotions are with the runner, and kind of like you can almost sympathize with what they're feeling when you're watching it, or empathize, whichever's correct. And you can, you know, you go through the motions of what she's going through, and it suddenly you go, oh, actually, you can relate immediately to what's happening, but it's quite interesting to watch it happen in front of you. And I think that that's kind of what, from watching it, that was the biggest takeaway, was just actually like, this is the exact opposite of what I thought it would be.
And it really kind of sucks you in, I think, in a way. I've seen it all the way through, you know, I had to, but I've also enjoyed watching it all the way through several times, probably 7 or 8 times all the way through. And it does unfold in a way that is really beautiful. Like it draws you in. You want to keep watching it. You're like, I know what happens here, you know. I think you know what happens, and you're sort of like, why am I so interested in this? But I was really pleased when I, you know, it was easy to put together kind of quickly right after we shot it, because it was such long takes and comes from the same road and same run. And but it was really powerful when I first watched it. I was excited that it worked, you know. And once I got some music on it, I was like, oh, this is you know, exciting.
I just went through the usual thought process of like, is she all right on the snow? That looks like she's going to slip.
But you would have that feeling when you're running too, right? You would sort of
like, yeah, but you would. That's what I mean. It wasn't sort of like, I wasn't waiting for a blooper. I was just like, this is my thought process that I would have on the run. Like, is the conditions good? And then at the end, she took her glove off. And I was like, I would have taken my gloves off a bit before. I think my hands would have got hot running. She was, you know, and it was quite strange to sort of like run without running, really. Like, but yeah, I mean, I think it's great, and I really enjoyed watching it. So
for me, when we were filming it, it's like, felt like one of the most Tracksmith things we've ever done in my mind. It was like, this is completely what I see when I'm on shoots and, you know, go out and 14 miles, and that's what I'm photographing. And you know, we don't really interfere with them, other than we'll pull over the car, or, you know, if they need to stop for some water or something, of course, you do that, you know. But it is really based in an approach that I've gotten to see so many runs in their entirety, and wanted to be able to show people that. You know, I think is something where in other sports, I love when you get to see kind of behind the scenes footage, you know, or anything like making a movie. I love the behind the scenes footage. I go to rehearsals at New York City Ballet to, you know, I enjoy that sometimes more than the performance. Like, it's fun to see people that are really dedicated to something in a moment of quiet doing that, not necessarily their performance moment. We see a lot of performance on a stage in a sense that, okay, this is their race. It's all on the line. But I think there's something really beautiful about watching her go for a run. Obviously Sam's dedicated her, you know, life to it. And she is very, very much at a level of running that she's not just beginning. And, you know, it's different stages of injury in her career at different times and all of that. And I think that that's really cool to watch something that's kind of casual in that way. That's just about being out there and going for that run and the consistency of that, at whatever place she was at on that day to do it.
Do you have that was in Colorado, wasn't it? Do you have a favorite place to shoot? Is you know, when you're traveling the world, is there a place, like, well, obviously with cycling, the mountains is probably where you would have got some of the best, you've probably taken some of your favorite images perhaps, but is there a favorite place to shoot?
I think just there's certain roads that it's really about, for me, for shooting running, it's about the person in the road and like the story of what's going on. And I wouldn't say, I think I can find interest in any place. Colorado is amazing. That road was amazing. It definitely changes, the scenery changes a lot on that road. And so it made a great spot for the film. I'm really happy with that. And yeah, sometimes when you're in like Arizona and it has that amazing light, that amazing sunrises and things like that, that helps. And not the waking up early is not my favorite thing about the job that I do, especially in the summer when we have to shoot sunrise and it's, you know, 4 a.m. or something. It's something I have to live with being a photographer, because you've got to have the light. But, you know, it makes it worth it when you get like a nice Arizona sunrise or something and not a cloudy morning and you woke up for nothing.
What's the sort of next thing you want to sink your teeth into there, Emily? You get is it sort of, so not necessarily with the brand, but kind of just as a photographer, what are you thinking? Like, what have you got, a subject matter that you want to look at? Is there anything coming?
My focus has been on directing for the past few years, and sort of Tracksmith has been the place where I'm shooting the most photography, and pretty selective about the other photography jobs that I take, just as I'm focusing on directing a lot more and directing commercials and stuff, and hopefully moving into feature film someday. That would always be the goal, and has been the goal. So that's my main focus right now, but I do have a personal project that I want to do in photography this year, trying to make sure I make time for that. I think that's something that is hard to keep making time for. At a certain point, you end up shooting a lot of commercial work, and just, you know, it's easy to not make yourself go do a project on your own that you've wanted to do. And so I want to make time for that this year, for sure. It's been a while since I've done personal projects. So I've got a couple of those lined up for middle of the year and end of the year. And a lot of film projects as well, that just trying to see if I can get off the ground. And that's definitely the space that brings me the most inspiration right now. And you know, all in sports, and continuing to work in sports. My entire career has been in sports storytelling. So I'm very happy in that space, and think there's a lot more stories to keep telling, for sure.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and chatting through the creative process and making films and the future of running and how we're going to capture it and make it look great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So that brings the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. A huge thanks to our guest, Emily May, and to you, of course, for listening.
Subscribe to Runner's World magazine. Get 12 issues of the world's best running content delivered to your front door every month. Go on the internet and search Runner's World UK subscription and you'll find it. There's some deal as well. You get 3 issues for £5. But yeah, you know what? Just commit. Commit, guys. It's time to commit. And you should do that.
And if you don't want to commit, that's also fine. Just keep listening to the Runner's World UK podcast on Acast, iTunes, all your favourite podcast apps. Search Runner's World UK and do commit to subscribe, because that'll make us happy. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Nice.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.